The headlines, new data show Americans are buying millions more firearms, fearing violence and political uncertainty. Washington extends the New START nuclear treaty with Russia by 5 years, saying the move lowers the risk of war and helps prevent arms races. And the European Union rejects a UK demand to extend the grace period for checks on goods moving between Britain and Northern Ireland. Our top story for this half hour, firearm sales in the United States have set a new record amid political tensions in the country. Media analysis of background checks show that gun dealers sold more than 2 million firearms in January alone. Gun stocks also surged after supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the Congress building on January the 6th. These records follow last year's soaring numbers when more than 23 million firearms were sold across the U.S. Safety concerns, political uncertainty, investment, and the coronavirus pandemic have been reported as the main reasons behind the surge. President Joe Biden's pledge for banning the manufacture and sales of assault weapons also contributed to this spike. Data show that gun sales usually go up with the election of a Democrat president who is in favor of tighter gun controls. Matthew Fogg, a former chief deputy for the U.S. Marshals Service, says there are already a large number of guns on the streets in the United States due to the laxity in gun laws.
There are so many guns already on the street. People have access to guns here in the United States with the freedom of gun laws that we have. So pretty much, I've always said, the cat is already out the bag, so to speak, when you talk about the numbers of guns being out there and the numbers of subversive groups that even have access to these weapons. So, I mean, we saw what happened at the Capitol. We saw that when it comes down to guns rights, there are a certain part of this country that people believe you can walk around with guns and should be able to display open carry and that type of thing. And bottom line is that for the most part, I mean, when we're talking about the numbers of people in this country, millions of hundreds of millions of people in this country, and all the guns out there, I'm surprised we don't have more gun incidents. But the bottom line is we really don't. But the fact is that when you got people who are concerned about war, race wars, and all of these other things that are being spoken about, that's where your concern comes in, is where people, some of these groups get to the point that where, you know, if they took over the Capitol, they might do it anywhere else. If you go to the seat of government and no telling where, it could go next.
Another major U.S. airline is set to send furlough notices to thousands of its workers due to the prolonged industry downturn amid the coronavirus crisis. American Airlines says 13,000 staff, including pilots, flight attendants, and maintenance workers, are expected to be laid off if government aid is not extended. An executive says the airline is also planning at least 45% less flights in the first quarter. Last week, its rival United Airlines sent similar furlough warning to its 14,000 workers. COVID-19 has taken a heavy toll on the aviation industry worldwide. Due to travel restrictions, American Airlines reported an annual loss of $8.9 billion in 2020. Airline labor unions in the U.S. are seeking $15 billion more in federal payroll support for the industry to keep jobs. Well, the U.S. has extended the new strategic arms reduction treaty with Russia by 5 years. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made the announcement a day before the new START was set to expire. He expressed hope that it prevents an arms race between the two nuclear rivals. This comes after Russian President Vladimir Putin signed legislation that extends the accord. New START is the last remaining arms reduction pact between Moscow and Washington. It caps the number of nuclear warheads that the two sides can deploy to 1,550. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from other deals with Russia, including the 1987 INF Treaty. Iran's president has hailed an interim ruling by the International Court of Justice that it will take on Iran's lawsuit against U.S. sanctions.
The Hague-based International Court of Justice had ruled in our favor and issued an interim order for the U.S. to lift all humanitarian-related sanctions. The U.S. did not abide by the ruling, and that was a violation. But for us, that was a great victory. Then the Americans claimed that the ICJ did not have jurisdiction over the matter. The top UN court has been discussing the Iranian lawsuit for months. Washington tried very hard to prove that the ICJ had no jurisdiction over the case. But Wednesday's court ruling that it will take on Iran's case is another great victory for us.
Hassan Rouhani said the U.S. tried very hard to quash the case, arguing the court has no jurisdiction over the matter. Early U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price expressed disappointment, saying the top U.N. court did not accept, quote, well-founded legal arguments. On Wednesday, the ICJ unanimously refuted all the preliminary objections to its jurisdiction raised by the U.S. Tehran filed the lawsuit in mid-2018 after the U.S. withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and reinstated sanctions. Tehran accused Washington of breaching the 1955 bilateral treaty of amity and ruining millions of lives. Political commentator David Yagubian says the United States will probably pull out of the International Court of Justice if the World Court condemns the country.
Even if the United States, due to this ruling, finally just pulls out completely from its commitments to international law or to, relative to the jurisdiction of the ICJ, it's nevertheless critically important for the world community that the continued rogue behavior and scofflaw behavior of the United States is recognized. And these are the proper channels through which to recognize it. So Interpol, maybe not the most direct and appropriate method within international law to address U.S. scofflaw behavior, especially in the context of its treaty obligations, which even after the 1986 reduction of ICJ jurisdiction unilaterally by the United States, it still claimed that its treaty obligations were still under that jurisdiction. But I do expect that the U.S. will just simply pull out completely from any jurisdiction or commitments or responsibilities to the ICJ, as well as to the ICC, which is pursuing Israeli war crimes in Palestine, as well as American war crimes in Afghanistan, some of those war crimes directly implicating Mike Pompeo.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has ruled out any changes or addition of new members to the 2050 nuclear deal. Rouhani made the remark as the United States seeks to expand the agreement beyond Iran's nuclear issue. We have more in this report.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has signaled that it is willing to return to the 2015 nuclear deal from which former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally exited in 2018 and reimposed anti-Tehran sanctions. But 2 weeks after taking the helm at the White House, Washington's return to the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, still hangs in the balance. The U.S. says Iran should first come back to full compliance with the accord, but Tehran says it was Washington that walked away and hence it should fulfill all its obligations, which include the lifting of all sanctions. Amid the standoff, Iran's foreign minister warned that the Biden administration has a limited window of opportunity to re-enter the agreement. He, meanwhile, suggested the question over who must take the first step in returning to the JCPOA could be resolved by EU foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell.
He can put his hat as the coordinator of the joint position and sort of choreograph the actions that are needed to be taken by the United States and the actions that are needed to be taken by Iran.
In reaction, the European Union said it is working extremely hard to salvage the deal and is in talks with the U.S. administration to see if sanctions could be lifted. And this is how the U.S. reacted to Zarif's suggestion.
If Iran comes back into full compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA, the United States would do the same. And then we would then use that as a platform to build a longer and a stronger agreement. that also addresses other areas of concern.
Such a stance was earlier echoed by Secretary of State Antony Blinken, which is in line with Washington's policy to expand the JCPOA beyond Iran's nuclear issue. French President Emmanuel Macron has also said Saudi Arabia should be involved in any new negotiations with Iran about the deal. But Iran's president has reiterated that the JCPOA remains unchanged.
I clearly tell the global community, and especially the countries in the JCPOA, whether it's 4+1 or maybe 5+1 in the future, that no clause of the JCPOA will change. Know this, and no one will be added to it.
After the U.S. pullout of the JCPOA in May 2018, Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories, the EU, Britain, France, and Germany, to make up for the U.S. move. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments. Iran then reacted by scaling back on its commitments under the accord. Iran says its measures are fully reversible upon the full compliance by the remaining signatories. Presently, questions arise as whether the Biden administration will follow the path of its predecessor against Iran or will try to rectify the Trump-era policy, which has been described as a failed approach even by some of Washington's close allies.
The European Union has rejected a UK demand to extend a grace period for checks on goods moving between Britain and Northern Ireland. European Commission Vice President Maros Sefcovic said a post-Brexit trade deal signed in December gives London enough tools to solve the problems. However, he said the bloc will work aggressively with Britain to resolve difficulties that have already impeded deliveries of goods. On Wednesday, British Cabinet and Office Minister Michael Gove asked that grace periods for the transportation of food to Northern Ireland be extended until 2023. The UK left the EU on January the 1st. Under the deal, Northern Ireland remains in the EU's single market, but checks are imposed on goods moving between there and Britain with a three-month grace period for food items. Former EU top-level technocrat Mario Draghi has been entrusted by the Italian president, Sergio Mattarella, with the task of forming a government of national unity after the sinking of negotiations to patch up the coalition that had supported outgoing president, or rather prime minister, Giuseppe Conte's executive. Max Civili reports from Rome.
Italy's president of the Republic, Sergio Mattarella, gave Mario Draghi a mandate to attempt to form a new government after efforts to salvage the coalition supporting outgoing prime minister Giuseppe Conte had failed. Draghi, 73 years of age, had largely vanished from public view since his mandate as president of the European Central Bank ended after 8 years in 2019. His name emerged as a potential prime minister when the government crisis sparked in Italy in mid-January. The crisis had been triggered by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, whose unexpected decision to withdraw his small party's support to the previous executive had forced Conte to resign.
Con questa speranza,
I am confident that the unity and the capacity to give a responsible response will emerge from the discussion with the parties, with the groups in Parliament. The challenges are to defeat the pandemic, complete the vaccination campaign, offer responses to everyday problems, and relaunch the country using the extraordinary resources from the EU.
The country desperately needs to secure an immediate massive injection of liquidity into its staggering economy. Italy has reported its biggest contraction in GDP since the end of World War II, following the pandemic. The National Bureau of Statistics estimates the country's economy shrank by almost 9% last year.
What is there to understand is if the next government will be technical or political. This is for Prime Minister-designate Draghi to find out. Draghi unusually met with outgoing Prime Minister Conte after receiving the mandate to see if he can also count on his support.
It cannot be taken for granted that a Draghi executive would win substantial backing from parties across the political spectrum. Many five-star movement lawmakers have said they will not vote in favor of a technocrat government led by Draghi arguing the only possible executive must be a political one.
Also, nationalist Brothers of Italy leader Giorgia Meloni warned her party would not support Draghi as prime minister, calling her lies. The anti-immigrant, anti-EU League party of Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi's centre-right Forza Italia party to abstain any vote for him. Max Civili, Rome.
The United Nations has pledged to do its utmost to make sure that Myanmar's military coup fails. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he will mobilize all the key actors and international community to put enough pressure on Myanmar's military junta. He added that it's absolutely unacceptable to reverse the results of an election in Myanmar. On Monday, Myanmar's military declared 1 year of emergency and detained top officials, including the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. The coup and detentions come after days of escalating tensions between the government and the military. Military generals claimed the last parliamentary elections were fraudulent. The military action has been condemned globally. Elsewhere, the International Organization for Migration says hundreds of Yemeni families have been displaced since the start of 2021 due to the conflicts in several governorates of the country. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more.
According to the International Organization for Migration, at least 600 families were forcibly displaced from their homes in Yemen in January due to the increasing confrontations in several governorates of the country.
The areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition suffer from instability and security and the spread of armed groups. Therefore, the residents of these areas are leaving to save their lives from missiles, projectiles, and armed confrontations. These have all been confirmed by the international organizations, including IOM.
The IOM says Al-Hudaida, Al-Dale, and Taiz governorates have the highest number of displaced people. As the war continues in these areas, most displacements occurred during the last week of January, indicating that 2021 may witness more of this crisis.
The issue of displacement can only be solved by lifting the imposed siege. Those displaced greatly suffer from the absence of support from international organizations. These people must be among the priorities of the humanitarian operations. It is shameful to see an increase in the number of displaced people in 2021 due to the continuing armed conflicts.
Millions of families had to leave their homes for survival since the beginning of the war in Yemen in 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on the Arab country, killing thousands of civilians, including women and the children. 2021 doesn't seem to be better than the previous years for Yemenis, as the war continues to create new difficulties for thousands of people who had to migrate for their lives. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
Iran جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خون که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبریز.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. In the limelight.
A rally in the price of silver lifted the metal to an 8-year high on Monday, 1st of February, but those gains faded as some investors questioned the ability of social media-driven traders to move prices in a bigger, more liquid market. The retail traders' darling, GameStop Core, sold off, giving up all of Friday, 29th of January's strong rally, but other shares caught up in the Reddit rally, including BlackBerry Limited and AMC Entertainment Holdings, extended the advance that has brought pain to short sellers. We now present you an article written jointly by Tom Westbrook, Thayagaraju, Adinarayan, and Jeff Lewis. The piece is titled Silver Becomes the New GameStop as Metal Soars to 8-Year High. The news report was published by the Reuters news agency. Please stay with us for more of Tom Westbrook, Thayagaraju, Adinarayan, and Jeff Lewis's article. Silver rallied on Monday, 1st of February, touching levels last seen in 2013, as an army of retail traders stormed into the metal, switching their focus from GameStop Corp, BlackBerry Limited, and other stocks, whilst short sellers licked their wounds after a brutal start to 2021. As traders turned their attention to silver, a bigger and more liquid market than the individual stocks targeted until last week, shares of GameStop fell by a third in morning trade and were down 22% at $253 in early afternoon trading. Its shares have soared 1,600% this year as a small-time investors scooped up assets big fund managers had bet against or shorted. Another retail darling, AMC Entertainment Holdings, was up 8% on Monday, having risen more than 500% this year. BlackBerry shares were higher in both New York and Toronto trading. Data from financial analytics firm Ortex showed on Monday, 1st of February, shorting shares of GameStop cost hedge funds a total of $12.5 billion over January. Amazon's Simple Storage Service, or Amazon S3 Partners, said the number of GameStop shares shorted fell by over half in a week as these short sellers covered their bets, although the retailer remained a highly shorted stock. Melvin Capital, which bet against GameStop, lost 53% in January. As a new week of trading begins, it remains to be seen how long the Reddit-fueled rally in traditionally unloved stocks will last. More immediately, it could mean more market losses if hedge funds have to keep selling to meet redemptions or write their portfolios. Longer term, they may have to shift strategies. Monday's moves were relatively small compared with swings recently, when small-time traders who organized in online forums and traded with fee-free brokers such as Robinhood saddled several powerful hedge funds with losses under short positions. Instead, the frenzy was more apparent in spot silver, which headed for its biggest one-day rise since 2008. The iShares Silver Trust ETF, the largest silver-backed ETF, was up 9% in U.S. trading. According to BMO Capital Markets, Friday's 29th of January retail inflows into the ETF totaled around $950 million, equivalent to 2 weeks of demand in a total annual silver market of $25 billion. Portfolio manager Maria Smirnova at precious metals-focused fund manager Sprott Inc., a long-term silver investor, said that silver market is not large, about 1 billion ounces annually, or $28 billion at spot, so it is relatively easy to move the price. She said, gold and silver are direct beneficiaries of low to negative real interest rates and fiat currency debasement. She added, a general economic post-COVID recovery is also helping the silver price. She says silver is also benefiting from being green, used in solar panels, electric vehicles, and fifth-generation networks, but it remains far off a 2011 high of almost $50 per ounce. Silver's increase of almost 20% since Wednesday, 27th of January, ignited a rally in silver mining stocks globally, with Fresnillo PLC shares soaring 14% in London trading. Toronto-listed silver miners rose sharply. Big gainers were First Majestic Silver, Fortuna Silver Mines, Silvercore Metals Inc., and Pan American Silver. Goldman Sachs said the amount of position covering last week by U.S. hedge funds, buying and selling, was the highest since the financial crisis more than a decade ago. Global hedge funds industry body AIMA said on Monday, 1st of February, Wall Street's retail trading frenzy has distorted markets. Some on the online Reddit Wall Street Group, or WSB, urged followers to keep their focus on GameStop. Referring to GameStop's decline from nearly $500, a user posted, "We just have to stick to the same plan we've had all along. Hold. We didn't go through the bloodbath last week for nothing. Keep it up, boys." Wall Street's main indices climbed on Monday following a recent steep sell-off, as the shift in the retail trading frenzy to silver drove up mining stocks. Miners also lifted European shares. The furore began on Thursday, 28th of January, after posts on the Wall Street Bets Reddit message board, the same one used to spark frenzied buying of GameStop shares, urged investors to buy physical silver. One forum participant posted, "Get out there and buy at least 4 ounces of silver as soon as you can." Retail traders poured a record $40 million Australian dollars, or $30.6 million US dollars, into Australian ETF Securities Physical Silver Fund by the afternoon. A silver ETF in Japan surged 11%. Global short interest in silver, or the cumulative value of bets it falls in price, is equivalent to about 900 million ounces, just short of annual global production. Banks and brokers hold most of that, but it is not clear whether they are net short on the metal or whether their bets offset very big physical holdings. Analysts say a silver short squeeze is unlikely. Unlike at GameStop, there are no holders of massive silver short positions who can be forced to abandon them in big enough numbers to send prices through the roof. Rafi Boyajian, a senior investment analyst at XM, in a note said, "Unlike single stocks, the market for silver is much larger and more complex and therefore more difficult to manipulate." JP Morgan Chase analyst said, fundamentals did not just supply a sustained decoupling of silver price from that of gold. Gold prices rose less than 1% on Monday, 1st of February. But they warned the frenzy of retail buying has rebased silver prices higher for the time being.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, in November of last year, a controversial bill was drafted in France which would prevent journalists from filming police during arrests. Now, people have regularly taken to the streets in Paris and other cities to demand that the law does not come into effect this January. Will protesters be able to keep this from becoming law, and what they say would take away the checks and balances to help prevent police abuse and brutality? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this debate.
Protesters have taken to the streets in dozens of French cities against a security bill they say will restrict the filming and publicizing of images of police brutality. Demonstrators said the draft legislation will lead to more censorship and less freedom.
This bill has one objective, to allow a surveillance of the territory by drones. We are, of course, against the ban for journalists to film and to publish pictures of police officers. They want to prevent the publication of footage of police violence. The citizens say we don't want this law at all.
A total of 70 groups, including the Yellow Vests, organized the protest. Protesters said the new law opens the door to a generalized surveillance of the population, the use of drones, and the ban to film police officers.
French people have been the victim of police violence for a long time, in the suburbs more than elsewhere. There is more and more violence during demonstrations. The citizens should understand that we are here to defend their future liberty and the right to film. We must be able to show the judges that sometimes there is police violence. Pictures are sometimes the only evidence.
Footage of white police officers beating up a black music producer in his Paris studio on November 21 has fueled anger over the legislation, condemned by many as signaling a swing to the right by President Emmanuel Macron.
We've got for a lot of years now in France a lot of discussions about identity checks, which are very more likely to be happening to young people, to men, and to men with different backgrounds from origin, Arabic people and black people. So this kind of systematic background checks and identity checks, it participates to a state racism in French, especially about the police, and so we are fully supporting the Amnesty report.
Last week, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and four other rights groups warned that they will file a lawsuit against the French government for what they called systematic discrimination by police officers carrying out identity checks. Even French President Macron admitted recently that there was a problem of discrimination during identity checks. The new security bill will be debated in the French Senate in about 1 month. Some senators declared they want to rewrite the bill, but most protesters here simply want to abrogate it. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program out of New York, journalist and author Daniel Lazar, and out of London from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Raza Kazem. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in New York. And Daniel, why do you think the French government has proposed such a law at this time?
Yeah, Macron is under great pressure from the far right, from the National Front of Marine Le Pen. And in order to hold her off, he's adopted a policy of of trying to co-opt her program by toughening up the police and toughening up state responses to protests and demonstrators, and using generally more punitive measures. I mean, France is feeling the strain of COVID, the pandemic, and a severe, savage economic contraction. Tempers are rubbed raw, conflict is rising, and the state feels it has no choice but to respond in a militant manner, and that's the only way Macron knows to hold off the challenge from those even further to the right.
Well, what about that, Reza? I mean, Daniel said tempers right now are raw, it's sensitive, they're under a lot of pressure, but as a matter of fact, isn't that even more of a reason to make sure that there are checks and balances on things in France?
I think one of the things that is happening with this particular law is this whole idea of making sure that any police brutality that's carried out is not going to be filmed. And this is particularly something that is conducive or signals that what we're seeing is the emergence of a police state and the different powers that it actually has as a result of it. Because if you don't, on the other hand, we've seen also that many police authorities, police people on the streets and on the front lines are actually carrying cameras and so on in which they can film what's actually going on. And this allows for making sure for there to be accountability. What we're seeing with this is that accountability will be selectively chosen, and where needed, evidence can be disposed of by the police officers if need be. And in this particular case, what we're talking about is a serious infringement on rights. It's not just about the fact that there's a lot of pressure and so on. We've seen this kind of deliberate move mm-hmm. over years and decades in this direction. What we're seeing also is that this is something that is very much reminiscent of what used to happen and what was certainly talked about in terms of happening in the Soviet Union spheres of influence, in particular the Stasi police state of East Germany. And so what we're seeing is very much a reemergence of some of those ideas and some of those actual things being put in place. Mm-hmm. And it's got a label of democracy on top of it to try and sweeten what is actually being done. So I think there are some serious issues that are there, and France needs to be called out for what it is, that it is going in the direction of a police state. And that's what it's about.
Well, Daniel, I mean, during this period of grave dissatisfaction of the French people towards their government, doesn't this type of law simply make the Macron government even less popular than it already is? I know you talked about trying to appeal to the far right and Le Pen and those who follow her, but in general, as far as looking at the overall French electorate, couldn't this be dangerous for the government itself?
It certainly could be, yes, but I think that Macron believes he has more to gain than to lose through this kind of policy. He's trying to appeal to the conservative part of the French electorate, which is fed up with disorders in the streets, wants a tougher police response. And if it doesn't get it from Macron, it'll turn to the National Front and Marine Le Pen. So that's the game Macron is playing. He's trying to carve out a base for himself in an angry right of center electorate, and he's hoping to succeed. So we'll see what happens. But unfortunately, if Macron loses, we could very easily see power slip into the hands of the National Front, and that would be, of course, an even greater disaster. I'm not that I'm trying to make excuses for Macron or in any way justify his policies, because I'm not.
Okay. Well, Reza, immediately following the proposal of this law back in November, a video went viral in France showing a black music producer being brutalized by French police. Do you think that this has played any role in getting more people on the streets to protest against this law? And what could have happened in that same case if there had not been any film of the situation?
I think to answer your first question, it's quite clear that in any kind of law enforcement situation where there is no evidence to suggest and there's no one from within the police who were involved in that process of brutalizing an individual that they are seeking to arrest or seeking to question or whatever, then the police inevitably have backed each other's stance or have gone quiet and not said anything against their own colleague in terms of the repercussions they might have within the policing fraternity and their careers and so on. So this is something that needs to be understood, that this is something that is very much there. And in terms of the problems within this, with this actually being filmed in terms of happening to a black individual, I think the problem that the people are seeing, that once this goes out, that with any kind of injustice that is going to be coming into the forefront and going to be legislated in this way, then inevitably things that are targeted at minorities, be they Arab or black or whatever, in this case, the instance you're talking about is a black individual being targeted in this way. What people here have recognized from the white community in France is that this could be something that will give police powers that are beyond something that they are prepared to accept. But we need to understand the racial element that exists within this context, and in particular within the context of France. We're talking about a country that is deeply racist in terms of its attitudes towards people, institutionally racist in many of its institutions, and that's something that is put out there, and it's something that comes up every regularly in terms of how that institutional racism is also impacting on the racist attitudes of ordinary people in the country. And I think that's something that needs to be recognized and said for what it is, that that is what the problem is and that is what's going on. So there is different layers, if you like, to that.
Well, Daniel, in your perspective, how common is police brutality in France anyway?
It's very hard to answer that kind of question because evidence is very hard to obtain. There's a code of silence among police officers, and very often a criminal case boils down to an individual cop's word against an individual defendant's word. So it's difficult to prove, and it's difficult to know. It's kind of the phenomenon is kind of in a black box.
So with that being said, I mean, wouldn't the government know to begin with that there's definitely going to be backlash in suggesting something like that that would not be in the benefit of the average citizen?
Well, because the government thinks that maybe in balance it'll be politically beneficial to the government. That, in other words, that more citizens will approve of this policy than disapprove of this policy. Yes, a certain vocal element is taken to the street, in my opinion, to protest this move towards police authoritarianism, but they're not the entire electorate. And so therefore, some portion of the electorate may approve of these measures, may approve of a tougher police response. That is Macron's gamble. That's what he's trying to do. So we don't know how it will play out. Certainly in the United States, police violence is a massive problem, completely out of control, the citizen, many people are up in arms over it, but many people support a tougher police response. So this is what the political struggle is all about.
Indeed. Well, Raza, there have been growing complaints by many French of increasing surveillance by security forces in the country. Why is it, on the one hand, the government increases surveillance techniques against the people, and on the other hand, Paris doesn't want journalists to keep watch over police?
I think in terms of the direction that they want to go in, that they want that surveillance to be something that they can use and weaponize for their own political ends. It's not about something where the police should be a force, an institution that actually works for the community in terms of making sure that policing takes place in a sensible and a way that brings confidence into the community. But when the state goes about these kind of things, where they increase surveillance, where they reduce the ability of the ordinary citizen to challenge the police, even by filming some brutality or whatever that might be taking place, then what you're doing is increasing, as I said before, the idea of creating a police state and continuing down that route. And when we talk about one of the three phrases that is often associated with France, and it's something that is very much part of the publicity relations exercise that France carries out internationally about liberté, as it calls it, it's quite, you know, I think it's a bit of a joke that they dare to say that about anything that happens in any other country around the world in terms of policing, considering the direction that they're actually going in. And I think that one of the first things that needs to be said about this, that France is a police state. It's not about liberté, fraternité, etc., etc. It is about reducing the rights of individuals and citizens. And in answer to your question, it's about weaponizing surveillance and for it to be used as a tool when it suits the French political establishment, whichever strand of it it may well be interested in a particular direction that it wants to go in. And so it's all part of that those same machinations.
Daniel, your take on what Reza just said, I mean, because yes, France likes to brag about its democratic roots and having liberty for all of its citizens. Has it simply become a slogan with the reality being something very far from the truth?
Unquestionably. I mean, yes. I mean, that's been the story for much of modern French history. But yeah, I mean, France as a country, it's a large urban country with a swelling underclass, many of them immigrants or racial minorities. There's crime. There's a war on drugs, whose impact in terms of undermining civil liberties can't be underestimated, can't be overestimated. I mean, France is subject to the same authoritarian tendencies of every other advanced industrial state on Earth, including the U.S., Britain, Germany, etc. And they, all of them, are drifting in a more and more overt authoritarian direction as the social crisis, the economic crisis, intensifies. And that crisis is already acute. I think it's going to get worse and worse in the coming period. And these governments are responding by unleashing the police, adopting more punitive measures, that seems to be the direction that they are heading in.
Reza, your take, same question. Do you think that, what's the reasons in your perspective that countries like France is going towards a more authoritarian way?
Yeah, I mean, we need to, I mean, if we come across from France, across the English Channel, and come to Britain itself, we need to understand that what was pejoratively, derogatively looked at institutionally in terms of what the police had actually done in terms of infiltrating and abusing the communities and so on, in the way that surveillance was actually carried out, in the way that abuses took place within that policing context. What we are now seeing is that police are being asked and told that they will be protected under the law by laws being passed which will allow them to carry out these actions, and they'll be protected. So it's one law that will be applied to the police, there'll be another law that will be applied to the ordinary person. And what we are seeing is that as this direction actually continues, the idea of more and more countries and more ideas of the police state being entrenched in different sections of law, the establishment, the institution, the more problems ordinary people are actually going to have. It's going to start off by targeting racial minorities. It will start off by targeting people who are, who have some kind of communities that are disadvantaged and so on. And inevitably, as it happens with, and there are plenty of examples, going back to the terrorism laws and so on that were started at the beginning of this century in the UK, which have gone on to target ordinary people, the wider white community. And this is something that is very much going to be happening here. And this culture stems from this idea that the end justifies the means. The principles are not even being paid lip service to, that philosophy is not something that is acceptable.
Daniel, do you think at the end of the day that this law is going to be implemented? Because as we were saying, there has been a lot of blowback, but as you also said, there are those who actually support it. So your assessment at the end of the day, will it pass or not?
My assessment is that it will pass, that Macron thinks it's very important. Macron thinks he's got to show that he has a strong hand, that he will not be cowed, that he's resolute, and that he's determined to hold off a challenge from the radical right. So I think in the end it will become law.
And Reza, your prognosis, near future of France, we're going to see a continual deterioration of rights for citizens and others?
I think that's inevitable. I think that's, if you chart it, before the idea was that the concept of liberty and so on was actually talked about and brandished about around the world, it's something that is being done in France to actually keep on emphasizing these concepts and so on. But actually what has been going on, if you chart the history, and it's just not just in France, it's happening in Britain as well, in terms of what the rights are going to be, what people can and can't do, and how the spaces in which people can actually express themselves and have legitimate freedoms to actually be able to express discontent and to be able to protest. All of those things are being squeezed so that the net effect is the reduction of people to be able to say something, and that is very much reminiscent of a police state and fascism. And I think, unfortunately, while they might call it democracies, that's the direction that things are actually going in.
And it seems, unfortunately, history continues to repeat itself. On that note, I appreciate both of you being with us. Daniel Lazar out of New York, journalist and author, and Reza Kazem from the Islamic Human Rights Commission out of London. Appreciate you both being with us. And as always, nice to have you with us on another debate.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. Please stay tuned. Sometimes our dear brothers and sisters come to us and ask why our prayers are not answered. The answer to the question is in Ayah 11 of Surah Al-Isra, which states, "Man prays for ill as avidly as he prays for good, and man is overhasty." The main theme of this ayah is that sometimes the human beings hasten in order to get the answer to their supplications. However, they don't know that they must not hasten to get the answer to their prayers and that they must be more patient. This haste of them will give them ill instead of good. Maybe the answer to their request is not given soon, but there is goodness in that answer for them later. Therefore, we must not hasten in getting the answers to our prayers and requests from Allah, and we must be more patient so that our prayers are answered on the right place and right time. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website,